In this episode of the Love the Problem podcast, we sit down with Thomas Mulhern of Globally Local and the host of the Global Denmark podcast. Over the course of the episode, we explain many things about Danish society, including how Danes love Vikings and what hygge means. This episode was in collaboration with the Global Denmark podcast, where Alex was a guest on the episode in their show last week, so don't forget to check it out afterwards. In the meantime, enjoy the conversation.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Love the Problem podcast. I'm here with Thomas from Globally Local, right? I said that correctly?
That is so
awesome. We're so excited to have him, but let's just jump right in with Thomas. Thomas, thank you so much for being here, and can you just get people to know a little bit about your background, and I'll get as far back as you want, and we'll probably do deeper, so.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Alex, James, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Background, how far back should we go to in the womb, or are we talking
what do you remember
on the journey?
From the womb?
It's a bumping
not
experience.
Much.
Not
much,
sure, right?
Thankfully. I'm originally from the States.
Whereabouts from?
Scranton, Wilkes-Barre.
Wow, that was really precise, right?
Yeah, I mean, look it up.
Your neighbor was Michael Scott?
I am made famous by The Office. By kind of indirectly, right?
Oh, that place. Okay.
Right. That's real too, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, so grew up there most of the years. I moved around a little bit. Lived the first 22 years on this earth in the States. Did my undergrad there in New England. And then I moved to Belgium back in 2008.
What was the driver for the move to leave the States and go to Belgium?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. I was curious about moving to Europe, actually. I wanted to check it out. I'd never been. And two of my professors in my undergrad had done their PhD at a university called Leuven in Belgium. And they said, hey, you got to go there. Do you like beer? You like chocolate? You like
Belgian women? Like
yeah, all the above. And you're going to be in good shape. So I applied for grad school there, got in, and I moved to Belgium in August of 2008. And that was the last time I lived in the States.
Cool.
Okay. So you've been out in the States for quite a while now then.
Yeah.
And what first off, would you say the differences that you see? Would you class yourself as European now? Or is it, you know... You're still American, right? But is it, you know, different cultures? Or?
Still American, more European dressed.
I saw the show.
I don't know. Although I mean, some people are saying I'm losing my accent, but I can't judge that. Alex, can you attest to
it? I would say no. I've been out of the States for most of the last 10 years as well, and I feel like I talk to people and they immediately go, "Oh, you're an American." I go, "Oh, yeah, I guess so." Like, yeah. I think we stand out pretty quickly, yeah. even if.
Is it because of the socks and the sandals?
I'm not wearing the socks and sandals. That's not
okay. I think that plays a role. And
yeah,
the baseball hats.
Baseball hats.
Just randomly talking to everyone.
Yeah.
No, but I do think that from my experience from being overseas, we have, how would I say this, created a more neutral accent,
sure.
and kind of brought it down and made it more smooth and just easier for people, other, you know, non-natives to understand you, and just that kind of almost a. I was reading a negotiation book recently. They were calling it the radio voice.
Yeah,
like I feel like my life is a constant radio voice now, because it's just, you're trying to make it clear, you're trying to make it smooth.
That's right.
You go for comprehension, and that's just how you. I don't know. That's how what I found for me, and I don't know if that.
Yeah, I think it definitely adapting and flattening out the accent, and maybe dropping some grammatical rules when you're in different conversations to make it easier.
Do you change when you go home? Do you like to like back to the accent? I have to. Like, my sister doesn't understand me if I speak in this kind of international way. Everyone thinks it's British, but it's not.
Yeah, I think they like the local lingo. Yeah, in general, I think if I come back home, you try to assimilate back into the old way of doing, because otherwise you're an elitist, strange European dude.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's the thing. So at home, you're a foreigner now, but here...
Yeah.
You're a foreigner as well. I mean, just touching upon that, the kind of this kind of expat kind of movement that kind of goes through, and where do you identify yourself from?
Indeed. I mean, it's that ambivalence, right, of home. And definitely as the years go by, the more ambivalent it becomes. I would definitely characterize Copenhagen is home now, yeah, with my wife and my daughter, and kind of the life. I've been in Copenhagen now for 8 years.
Toluca?
Tax could hang.
Stop speaking a language I don't understand.
That means thank you. But yeah, I mean that, and you know, I work with expats all the time, and also, you know, third culture kids. And one of the big concepts is where do you belong? What is home? And that psychological, it's transition from it's a place to maybe where you grew up to this kind of these associations and more the ambivalence.
Quick off that. Let's say for you or for the people you're dealing with, and at least let's say a jump that I've personally made is from the number of places I've been in over the last decade, I feel like I've made a jump to just seeing like the planet as my home and becoming sort of a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
And sort of removing these nationalistic border things that we've set up that are very artificial and arbitrary, and just being like, well, actually, you know, I'm a human from the human race living on planet Earth. I'm a citizen of the Earth. Like, I don't know, that really resonates with me. I don't know if that resonates with you or some of the people that you're dealing with. Or
yeah, I mean, that for me is kind of the end state that I hope humanity can someday get to. I don't foresee it in my lifetime, but I think that global citizen mindset is kind of what I hope for. I kind of approach it. I run a company called Globally Local. So it's kind of about being a global citizen, but also still actively engaged in the local community where you find yourself at that time. So for me, it's also important that when you're an expat or you're in a different society, that you're still trying to participate and fully engage and bringing your competencies to whatever society you're in. Yep. Because I see a lot, you know, the expat bubble, right? And kind of this laissez-faire attitude towards the local community where you are at that time, and kind of it doesn't bother me what's going on. And I'm thinking, okay, I mean, if you chose to be here for X amount of months or years, just go for it. And that's kind of the attitude that I brought to it, even though I've been here for an extended amount of time.
Would you say is kind of like the minimum time that you should be here? Is it just like if you're here for 7 days, just immerse yourself, go for it? Or is it like, you know, if you know you're going to be here for 3 months, do you then go ahead and start taking lessons and trying to assimilate yourself? And, you know, it's very hard to speak Danish to Danish people because they, once they recognize it's not a Danish accent, they'll typically switch to English quite often at the time. And I think it's just for simplicity, then being polite as well and saying, hey, I understand you. Where you're like, hey, why don't you understand me?
exactly.
Kind of feeding, right? But
well, first of all, I would kind of unpack that. I would never advocate for assimilation. So okay. I work hard to distinguish between assimilation and integration. I would advocate for integration, where you kind of bring your uniqueness to the table, but not give away the part of yourself just to accommodate the local culture.
Nice.
But I don't know if there's a set time, you know, whether it's 3 months or, I mean, the typical tourist visa, what, 90 days? That's the legal requirement. I mean,
so past that, I guess, legally or illegally.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not condoning illegal.
Yeah, yeah. My intuition tells me that if you're coming as a student or going to live here for a certain amount of time to engage the best you can, I mean, and have realistic goals. I mean, whether you're going to be fluent in another language, I mean, we know it takes hundreds of hours to attain academic fluency. But you can kind of break it down and try to learn elements of a culture or and language is, you know, a part of that in a small amount of time.
I want to dive into this, and this might be slightly touchy, but we're also not a lot of Danes in the room, but I want to get into it.
Apart from the one right behind us.
But he's not on the mic, so okay. He doesn't count. Yeah.
We have the power.
We have the power. With this sort of learning language and the literacy,
sure.
A personal thing that I have a trouble with, and I've been here for about 4 years, is that there are less people in Denmark than live in New York City. Yeah. And the kind of cost-benefit analysis of like learning that language and sort of mentally getting over this hurdle of like, wait, like I grew up in a city that has more people here. Like if there was just a language that was only spoken by my city, like would I learn that? Like, no. Like that seems crazy for me. It's just sort of the cost-benefit analysis of,
sure,
let's say, spending all these hours that you're saying to learn the language compared to, I don't know, traveling around the country compared to...
But the benefits on the other side is that you get a secret language that you can speak with, like, select people around the world. It's like a secret club.
You become a code breaker.
I was on an island in Thailand, and then all of a sudden, there was a group of Danes, and I was speaking to them, randomly, finding about their holiday. I mean, like, it's a random thing, but it's a nice feeling. Do you, of course, I'm guessing... How is your Danish? Is that...
It's okay. I don't want to judge myself. I have Danes judge me, but... I understand both of your perspectives there. I mean, it goes back to how do I want to invest my time? And I mean, for me, learning the Danish language kind of had multiple layers to it. My wife's Danish. So actually communicating with her family, and really I could see that there was going to be a long-term connection established. And so for practical reasons, it made sense for me. But then professionally, it started to make sense that I wanted to have... the most influence possible and to really break into networks. Yeah. And I could see that in Denmark, it's a monoculture, and the language, though you can get away with English, forever, if you want to, really start breaking into all these different networks and, really participating at the highest levels, knowing Danish is a big help. So I saw both practical and professional benefits for learning it. But yeah, I mean, it depends on your situation, right?
Sure.
Because I can definitely see the cost-benefit analysis, right? I mean, learning English, I would say, is fundamentally different because it is the language of the world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm lucky enough that it was my mother tongue that I was just kind of birthed into. But I would definitely learn English if no matter where I was in the world because of that fact. Whereas Danish, I would only learn because I'm in Denmark. I'm not taking Swedish or Norwegian lessons. Mm-hmm. When I lived in Belgium... I took some Dutch, but my master's program was in English. So it's a different mindset. And I think there's different factors that go into it.
Going back to that then, was that kind of where the company ideas kind of first bubbled and started, where you put yourself in this bubble of yes, you're learning some of the language, but as a student, you're going through this as a process of, you know, in English, everything's going around you.
Yeah.
Do you think that's where it started or...?
Yeah, I think it was when I knew that I was going to move to my wife's home country.
I was worried about the power dynamic.
Quick
question on that. Did you meet her in Belgium?
We met in Belgium. So we met in a neutral country, right?
Literally. You can...
Literally the world's country to walk through the century.
Is that Luxembourg by any chance? Is that...
Yeah, so I think that's kind of when I knew I was coming to Denmark, I was acutely aware of, okay, the dynamics are going to shift because we're going from kind of these global citizens in a neutral country to now I'm going into my, fiance at the time's home country. And it's not my goal to assimilate and just become a Dane. But at the same time, I want to... bring my skills and do the best I can while I'm there. So that was kind of the...
How quickly did you make that choice in saying that you wanted to kind of say, actually, I'm going to go all in and not have, let's say, on Alex's side, where you say, I'm going to hold off for a little while and see how it is. Of course, different circumstances and...
Yeah. That's a really good question. I mean, I guess I came in with a mentality from day one that I was not going to be assimilated. But I was comfortable in the beginning, definitely being just with expats, because when I moved to Denmark, I couldn't speak any Danish. I had no network, little understanding of the culture.
Did it help having your partner's network there as well in getting into that and that process?
Because difficult to a degree.
It's your partner's friends as opposed to your friends.
Indeed.
And having that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't want to just merge onto someone else's life. You know, I was quite comfortable creating my own meaning in life.
Was she quite comfortable with you creating your own meaning in life?
Yeah. Okay. And you know, it wasn't her goal either to assimilate me.
Just having another attachment.
But she had a Danish law degree, so, you know, she couldn't use that abroad. So professionally, she had to come to Copenhagen.
I want to touch on something, and this is probably definitely going to be a tangent, but I want to touch on something that I'm seeing a lot, and we sometimes maybe touch on maybe on mic or off mic. For me, there seems to be this thing, and it's kind of your story, where I find the Danes very much have this, what I like to call the Viking mentality, where they send themselves abroad find partners, bring them back, and have sort of these sexual immigrants, sexual refugees, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Like, what are your thoughts like around that process and sort of being?
I'm positive towards that process.
And being sort of Viking plunder, basically.
Yeah. I identify as plunder. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I run into guys or girls now that are that plunder, right? Like myself.
And, so plunder or plundery?
Plundery, yeah. What is the plural of plunder? Good question. We'll have our research team.
Yeah, internet fact checkers.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they'll tell us.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. And, you know, I work in the kind of the global town attraction retention game. And it's no joke that the biggest factor is that kind of sexual refugee, right? If you can figure out a system for kind of maximizing that.
Do you know, just diving in, do you have a sense of like what percentage that is roughly? I mean, ballparks based on what you're seeing
of expats that are here because of a spouse.
Yeah,
it's either typically that or study, right? So actually, it'd be quite interesting to see what is on the other side.
I actually don't know the figures there, but I, you know, there's a lot.
But what's your sort of, let's say, unofficial from who you're dealing with, you know?
Yeah.
Put your finger in the air, rough guesstimate, percentage wise,
of Western expats that are in Denmark.
Western expats that are in Denmark because of partners.
God, I would say it's beyond studying that are here professionally. I would say it's above 50%.
No.
Just in terms of, that's my guess in terms of the data I have.
But it's a beautiful population to send out into the world. So, I mean,
it could be a lot worse.
Yes, exactly. There are some other countries that don't have the same Viking mentality just because, well, yeah, they're plunderings afterwards. I mean, that's what happened.
I ran an international school here in Copenhagen, and we created a bilingual program where it was in Danish and in English. And it just, you saw the floodgates open for families that were blended, where one was a Dane, one was an expat, because they were getting suddenly the best of both worlds, where it was this Danish kind of international mix. And that's where you could really see, okay, wow, there's tons of these type of families out there that have similar wishes and mentalities.
Do you see it as being a benefit or a hindrance for your children? Because I'm guessing you want your daughter to have American roots to some extent. Would she get an American passport and will you take her into that process?
So she's a dual citizen, yeah. She has the passport, so she has the right to vote.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows what the future will hold? I love the idea that she has kind of, she's both a part of the European Union and she's an American.
Now you're just showing off. I mean,
yeah. So she's lucky.
Well, not
she's
everyone lucky. In Europe is part of the European Union. It's not a thing, okay?
Just showing off there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I like the idea that she has possibilities. And, you know, the American culture has been exported so efficiently that I think it would be much more difficult, and I see this all the time, to maintain the Danish elements if we were in the States than vice versa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, just through Netflix and media and music and everything, that being an American abroad is actually probably one of the easiest to maintain those elements.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that I've been thinking about from my journey overseas is it seems like to me, honestly, the biggest export that the United States has is its culture. That we've been so efficient at exporting our culture to all these places around the world in a way that I think is both good and bad. I think there are sort of positive and negative parts about it. I'll just put out a small example. I was living in Korea. And somehow KFC convinced the Koreans that we eat KFC on Thanksgiving as like a way to market it to them. And
oh, you don't?
Yes.
I was just like, oh God. But like I had
sitting around the table. Just the bucket.
Like a bucket.
You know,
the traditional Colonel bucket, of course.
Yeah, of course. Like that's what all of us have for Thanksgiving. Yeah. And I had people like coming up to me seriously asking like, oh, isn't that what you do for Thanksgiving? And I was just like, no, like no. But just because they don't know any better and our advertising machine is so good.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, is that sort of what you see as well? Do you think that is what sort of most people get from the U.S. now that you've, you know, been in America abroad for so long?
This kind of mick culture, is that what you're thinking? Or
I mean, just all, everything between the movies and the ads and the TV and the music. Yeah. And it just, we've inundated every culture in the world.
I'm actually shocked, when I moved to Europe, about how informed Europeans are about what's going on and care about what's going on politically, you know, following all the recent shows and TVs. You know, I talk to people back in the States and they're like, what do they do over there? I'm like, same thing you guys do, basically. You know, they're watching the same shows, movies, you know. It's the American culture. It's everywhere.
So just to step outside from the bubble of America for a second, would you deem that as being the American culture that you've kind of given to the world, where you kind of watch movies and you kind of binge and fast food? Is that your gift to the world? Yeah. Is that what you would say?
I would definitely say music and, you know, the movies and television. Yeah, that's a huge part of it. I don't know what you think.
So I think if we do this, I think what you're talking about is the gift side of that. I think there's also the curse side to that, which is, I think, some of the consumerism that are kind of often... Yeah. I see it intertwined with some of these things.
Yeah.
Maybe not just music, but certainly some
intertwining obesity rates.
Obesity would be a big one.
High
consumption, like those types of things, I think, are coming out of the States. And as again, music not as much, but the film and the TV, as you start to see, like, at least what they think Americans live like, then they start to believe, oh, that's how we should be acting. And especially from some of the poorer countries that I've been to, that are rising, they sort of see the American way of life as the ideal. Even though I would strongly disagree.
And that's the ideal from what is portrayed through the medium of media.
Sure.
So TV, movies, and stuff like that, as opposed to... Yeah.
It's obviously not the ideal health. Yeah. And I don't think it catches much traction in, you know, modern social welfare states like Scandinavia as much as, you know, developing countries, right? Where they associate that with... wealth,
the ideals, and what
but I mean, it's just the type of thing of like I literally had people come up to me and be like, "So your college was like American Pie, like that was your college career?" And I was like, "Yeah, no, like, but just those types of
it wasn't."
yeah. That is one of the like negative byproducts is you get stereotyped as an American that this is how you live your life, like you're part of a show or movie.
I actually thought about it. You're probably the most stereotyped race in the world. I mean, screw the Irish, screw the other Asians, right? The Americans, really. from the portrayal of media and what everyone just assumes is the way that you live like and how you are.
Sure. And I mean, one of the things that I try to say right away is that the United States is over 300 million people and it's very diverse in terms of the way people live their lives. So trying to gauge how an American acts or thinks, that's kind of a strange question that doesn't make sense. Because there's always going to be this diversity of, just the pluralistic society. And that's what I think Danes have a tough time where they kind of fall into that trap of what does the States think about this? It depends who you ask in the States.
Yeah. And how diverse it could be. I mean, you get that to some extent with the microcosm of Denmark and the different areas looking after different parts and having that focus. I would say we saw the rise, let's say, if we're going back to the last elections, of nationalism coming through. And it wasn't from the major cities. It was from Ukans, Denmark. It was from the outside of the metropolitan areas and seeing, well, what can we make this change from? We're seeing the loss of our national identity in some way, either through the blending of color, through the blending of tones, through the blending of culture.
Yeah.
Why is this happening? We can't let this happen. Yeah. And you saw that it kind of spiked a little bit. You've seen it recede somewhat, but I think you're going to see another resurgence coming through again. You saw this rhetoric coming through with Brexit. If I look towards the UK, then people saying, hearing these stories of people with color or different accents saying, well, why are you still here? We voted to get you out of our country.
Yeah.
Kind of mentality of like, well, that's not what the vote was for.
No.
You realize that, right? And I think that... Yeah, I lost the point of that thread.
No, but you're identifying kind of the tribalistic threads that kind of underpin nationalism. And that's present in the States, it's present in Denmark, present in the UK. And I think it's based upon, fear and uncertainty, right? Especially, the more insular you are in a local silo, typically it doesn't happen in the cities because you're used to that natural diversity. Yep. But, when you're looking and hearing all these stories about what's happening in the big cities or, the fourth industrial revolution or the economy, it's moving in a direction you're not aware of, then you start closing in, right? So you look for where's my comfort zone? And that's people that look like you. They're part of your tribe. And those that are outside of it, they're kind of a de facto threat.
I want to touch on that, especially with how it relates to Denmark, because one thing that I feel like Denmark's going through at the moment from my years here is this sort of tension between the fact that they have this strong welfare state to support everyone who's here and so on and so forth. But as more, let's call it, non-Danes move in, there's becoming this tension of, well, do we want non-Danes to have these services, and how much can the state really support that? And sort of, to some extent, I think they're having an identity crisis of, you know, what does it really mean to be Danish?
Yeah.
I don't know. And what are your thoughts? Are you seeing similar things, or what are your thoughts around that, yeah, kind of concept about what's happening here along that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, I think to understand kind of Danish culture, you have to understand the notion of trust, that the trust in institutions and between citizens is so high, maybe the highest in the world, that it underpins the whole social welfare model. Mm-hmm. So when you have people coming in from outside of the trust paradigm that are foreigners, there's a reluctance for Danes to open up that circle of trust, right? You know, the economics of it is very clear. Expats coming into Denmark are a positive for the economy. I think 225,000 net Danish kroner per year is an educated expat in terms of contributing to the economy. And that's because they don't require a lot of the services of the welfare state, but they pay high tax. So the economics of it, it's false to say that they're taking away. I think Denmark, in terms of their history of immigration, they were a monoculture, and they the immigrants that they did have were refugees or from developing countries. So that was kind of the opposite, where it was more of a burden on the economy. But putting, you know, all these groups into one big pile is kind of what's happened in a way.
But don't you have to put all the groups into one big pile? It's to some extent where you kind of have to say this is the line, anywhere, you know, going into then what is an expat and what is a, you know,
sure, immigrant. I mean, in terms of human rights, yes. But in terms of an economic policy, no.
Oh, yeah. In that sense, of course.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that. Mm. But
But I think on that, just touching on that point, is I think, at least to me as an expat here, I feel like there's a number of sort of what I would see as sort of, let's call it vocalized contradictions,
sure,
around the fact that they've kind of lumped these two groups into the same bucket.
Sure.
And on one hand, they're saying like, oh, we know these, let's say, highly educated expats, and at least in my opinion, I could be wrong, you know, Denmark's a small country. They do have a lot of industry here. They're probably not producing enough high skilled labor to support those industries. So they need to import it. So we obviously want those people, but there's also this other group of people that from that point of view, they don't necessarily want, because they're coming from, you know, more your typical refugee, and it'd be, you know, take more services and so on and so forth. Sure. But they're kind of all lumped together. So you have, you know, on one side them saying, we want you this way, but we also don't want people this way. And they have these kind of, in my opinion, weird contradictions that kind of make it difficult for an expat to be like, well, where do you really stand? And I think all at the end sort of pushes people away.
Yeah.
Because it sort of becomes, well, you're telling me you want me, but you're also making me jump through these hoops.
Yeah.
What's going on? And there are other places, you know, there's another 170 countries in the world. I can go live somewhere else. Like, it's not a big deal for me. I mean,
yeah, indeed. I mean, I think you have this kind of national branding effort where Denmark is branding themselves as the country of hygge and the happiest or one of the happiest countries on earth. Mm-hmm. Come here and, you know, the kind of the mentality of the, okay, you'll experience hygge and you will be happy.
Can I just on that, can I touch on this? Is I feel like there's an element of almost though hygge is only for Danes. But in all seriousness, like I feel like, yes, it's the happiest country on earth, but blah, 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 but there is this element to it of like, it's really, really for the Danes. And it's really, really a Danish thing. And even though that we're trying to export it, like once you get here, it's not as open for the other people.
You know what? I think that'd be a great talking point to lead off from the next part.
Are we? All right. We'll jump into this on the next one.
With that, we'll take a little break and we'll join us back in a moment.
Hi, everybody. This episode was done in collaboration with the Global Denmark Podcast. I had the pleasure of being a guest on that show, hosted by Ed Lay and Thomas Mulhern. You should go check it out at globaldkpodcast.com. And let's jump back in to the next segment with Thomas. All right, and we're back. We were talking about how basically is the sales pitch that Danes are putting out there to come here and be Hugia kind of a bait and switch, and is Hugia only for Danes? And we didn't really finish that thought, so I'd be curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a conscious bait and switch. I think,
but it's an unconscious bait and switch.
I think there's a national there's data to support that Denmark and, you know, a lot of the Scandinavian countries are some of the happiest countries in the world. But when you actually look more into the data, the kind of the real word would be satisfaction.
Or I would say almost contentment.
Contentedness, yeah. And I talked to Mike Viking, who runs the Happiness Institute and wrote the book Hygge & Lykke. And he said, it's not that Denmark's the happiest country on earth. It's the least unhappy country in the world if you actually look at the data. So we're talking about having your basics in order. But of course, that's not the way it's branded. You know, you're thinking you're going to hop off at the airport and high five people. They're going to hand you a Carlsberg and there you go. You're on your way.
I think one of the other things from my point of view, and I think especially coming from the States and our sort of income disparity, is I feel like relatively the income distribution disparity within Denmark is relatively small. Yeah. And so you don't have this sort of, you know, I'm sure there's some of this, but not as large of the grass is greener in my neighbor's yard type of phenomenon, because your neighbor's not making stupidly more money than you are.
Sure.
Right? I mean, there are some differences depending on your roles, but it's not, you know, in the States, I think it's CEOs are making like 1,000 times more than their employees, and that's not happening here.
No.
I don't know. Do you think that is a driver as well, this sort of lower income distribution or?
Absolutely. I mean, the social welfare state creates that kind of your basic needs are in place. You know, there's lower disparity, creating a safer society. Again, the trust, there's lower corruption. So all those things, I think, play into the least unhappy country in the world phenomena. Yeah. Back to Hygge, though, I think Hygge is kind of this conscious coziness, right? It's planned. And one of the things we notice with Danes in terms of organizing free time is that it's hyper-planned, right? Yeah. You just want to go for a drink. Okay, cool, man. All right, let's look at our calendars. Hey, 3 months from now, let's do that.
Yeah, I can have one beer in 3 months.
Right. It's like, I'll be in Switzerland, but cool. I meant now. And I think
you can't do a random, like, you know, last minute, even for like a week thing.
No.
Like a week out, you want to do an event? There's not very
spontaneity,
much
spontaneity is at a premium.
So then sure. do you lose the spontaneity through the hygge? Is that because, is that, you know, is that, are those two?
I think for Danes, hygge is really, to be able to experience hygge is to be able to trust those that you're with. Again, it comes back to trust, and that means that you planned it and you're looking at all the dynamics that could go in. And if you have spontaneity, you have kind of uncertainty, and then maybe it's not hygge.
Do you see, let's say, one of the ways that I've rationalized, conceptualized this is I see hygge as sort of a defense response mechanism to the weather, of like, if they didn't create this hygge, like, everyone would be killing themselves for like 6 months of the year. Is that
9 months?
9 months. Fine. You're right. No. I underestimated it. It's 9 months.
Some part of the country. I mean, that's,
But I kind of feel like if that wasn't a thing, then you know said Denmark's the least unhappiest place in the world.
Sure.
It would probably quickly become the greatest unhappiest, you know, the most unhappiest place in the world.
Yeah.
Is that something you think about? Because that's something that I've kind of thought about. Is like, yeah, if they didn't have this home coziness and so on and so forth during the bad months here, it'd be pretty brutal.
Oh, for sure. I think that it is kind of a byproduct of living in the north, right?
But I think that's also the same way that we have a lot of pickled items, from foodstuffs to condiments. I mean, it's not just condiments. It goes, we pickle everything from, you know, just to keep, just in case. And I think is that stemming from then of the Viking heritage, or, you know, living off of what you can keep and what goes in. And I mean, yeah, you just got to understand there's a lot of babies in August. and mm-hmm. and there's more babies in August than probably most others because it's cold during that time. It's dark in Denmark.
Not during August, but 9 months pre-baby.
9 months beforehand. That's what I'm saying. It's 9 months before. It's cold and dark, and I mean that's what.
And what else are you gonna do?
Yeah, I'd say.
exactly.
You know, you've been brought into the country for one reason. I mean, no.
Yes. I mean, you got to fulfill your role.
Drink your goddamn schnapps and perform, man.
Yeah, exactly. Schnapps was one thing I had to really get into after being here in Denmark, and I never
Should we go down that rabbit hole?
Well, yeah, I've never seen someone drink so much beforehand in my life, and that was my partner's mother during Christmas dinner. You know, where from 10 o'clock in the morning, she would drink constantly through every other morsel until 4 or 5 p.m. in the afternoon and still stand.
All you have to do is call it a focused, and then you're not an alcoholic.
Yeah, a unifocust. And so it's beautiful cost. You can bring all the schnapps that was made throughout the entire year and consume your limitation.
Let me tell you, I love the idea of the focused. Like, I love that kind of lunch starting at 10 in the morning. It's just a big party.
It's the literal translation of focused is lunch. But there is no literal translation. In the same way with hygge, there is no literal translation of focused.
No.
You want to explain maybe a little bit?
To your global audience, what a focus. I mean, just imagine a lot of alcohol and kind of a mixture of okay to moderately okay food.
Yes.
And and see what happens.
I want to jump on this
with family and friends.
I want to jump on this actually because it's been driving me nuts while I've been living here.
Sure.
Like you said, Danish food is okay to moderately okay for the most part. Like, there's a couple of specific dishes, especially around Christmas.
Sure.
But let's say besides the new Nordic high-end Noma and all that.
I was going to say, where are you going with this, right?
Yeah, that's a different league.
Sure. That's a separate thing. But let's say the traditional food and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's not that good.
I wouldn't take Danish food over Italian food. I mean, I think there's a lot of other, you know, countries and foods that are superior. Yeah, for sure.
I think the northern climes in general, their cuisines are typically not great.
They're hearty.
I think, you know, hearty. That is a rather good
adjective. I mean, rye bread is the staple of the diet, yes. Right? And when I was growing up, rye bread was like the biggest fucking punishment you could get. And then here I am.
More than here I am
in this seventh circle of hell, doomed to eat rye bread.
No. But I mean, are you atoning for? This is my question.
Boiled potatoes. Is this a children's roast? I mean, it's one of these things where I think it all stems from the tradition of what's seasonal, or you know, this. You say new Nordic,
yeah.
But you know, you have all of these meats at a particular time throughout the course of the year, and there are dishes that go with the year, and what you have at Easter is the same every year, and what you have at Christmas is the same.
That's right.
And all the bits in between, and there's lots of holidays where you have fancy little bits that come along with it. So,
yeah.
But what is it with the fricadella you don't like? I mean, it's veal and pork mince together.
Fricadella is amazing. But I feel like you could literally count the number of dishes that are really good on one hand.
I think we're gonna do this.
You're gonna do this now. I mean, fricadella's on there. What's the fried pork belly, the really crispy pork belly dish?
Okay, Fleischestein.
Fleischestein.
Okay.
Is that the really crispy one you have at Christmas?
Yeah, Christmas.
It's like the full crispy pork belly.
Oh,
like
Kovenstein.
But it's like the whole like side of a pig, and you put it in the oven and you get it super super crispy. So the skin.
Yeah, Kovenstein. So I mean, like,
sorry to our vegan friends out there for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be aware, we're in a country where there's more pigs than people. So.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there are more pigs than people in this country.
That's a fun fact.
And fun fact.
That's just not a statement on how the general population looks, by the way. It's just FYI.
They're good looking pigs. So.
Yeah, okay. That's fair enough. So you got two. So I think you're struggling already. But yeah.
No, two. Those are my favorite. And then we're getting.
Well, let's talk about the rice pudding at Christmas. The Reis Edamame.
Yes. Rice pudding is quite good.
With the cherry sauce.
Yes, indeed. But the thing you have to make beforehand. I mean, that is a. They put it as a sweet dish, as a dinner dish, and you always get it in December one time.
Yeah.
Where you have to make the Riesengrund first, right. before you're able to add cream and sugar and all the nice bits
right.
that go along with it. You kind of have to suffer through.
It's a process, right?
Is that the Danish way of doing things? Like you kind of, you're going to get to the good stuff at the end with the cream.
And but you're going to suffer through a lot of stuff.
Well, it's that Protestant work ethic, right? You're not supposed to enjoy life. You're supposed to atone for your sins.
Is that part of the hygge process at the same time? Is that just a...
I don't know about that.
No, I'd say I can't think of them now. Actually, I think you could be right, Alex.
No, I mean there are certain smugabro, if I'm pronouncing
smugabro.
That. There's certain specific ones that I like the roast beef one with like the crispy onions. I think it's quite good.
But it's that's like a subclass of itself, right? There's so many different types.
Oh yeah, can you separate smugabro just as itself as?
I do
as
like
a dish,
the coffee right? up here. I mean, when you live in Belgium or like the southern European country. I don't know. It's not. You have the coffee there. It's crap.
The coffee is really good here, and the culture.
Wait,
is
wait,
really
you're
good.
Saying the southern climes that love and devote their times to coffee. You're not a big fan.
I'm more of the big Nordic latte.
Okay.
Type of dude.
In the glass.
In the glass.
Yeah. Was that something that took you by surprise after the Noir? So for all the other internationals, again, we're going to the Danishisms today, and I think it's going to be a running theme, but. To give you a hot liquid beverage, they'll serve it in a glass. A tall glass, mind you, unless you ask for a short drink. But it will be in a glass nonetheless. Yeah. And the temperature will be as you would expect from a boiling liquid.
Minor burns.
Yeah. There's no way of
but
putting a disclaimer on
that. You
can't
sue people in this country like you can do in this
and say...
so you're just screwed.
McDonald's like, we can't write on the glass. It's not possible.
Yeah. I remember this case of this woman who sued McDonald's because she burned her tongue, got millions.
And now they have to put it on there. That's a whole other show. As we go into that.
I would say the last thing, but none of these are, let's say, particularly Danish, but I think the bakeries here are very good.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, the Danish bakeries. I wouldn't say like what at the bakeries is, let's say, a specifically Danish pastry. That's not hard, but the actual, broadly speaking, the bakeries here are very good.
I think we've had this before, but Danish pastries, and no one actually claims fame to the Danish pastry.
Calling them Danishes?
We call them Vienna breads here, Vienbult. And then the people in Vienna, we asked some guy from Austria, he's like, I have never heard of this stuff.
I want nothing to do with this.
I think it originated in Turkey or in Hungary.
we'll find out during the whole season.
Someone will let us know. We'll have a guest who comes on. I'm from the town.
They'll win a year's supply of Danish pastry. Yeah. but no, jumping back into off the random that tangent that we had. I mean, going back into the Danish hygge and being here, and is that part of the food getting into the lifestyle and getting into how, because that is also part of not assimilating, but being part of the culture and a big part of it.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's an expectation that you'll understand what dishes go for what event, right? But there's not that kind of food culture outdoors, right? Because of the climate or eating out is so expensive. So that's more, again, insulated to the home. Or if you're invited to guests, there'll be an expectation that they know exactly what's on the menu, right? If it's Christmas or if it's Easter.
Can I jump on that point a little bit too? One thing that I find, especially as an American, very, very weird here. Let's say you're invited to a guest's home.
Sure.
Everything is planned like to a T.
Yeah.
Of like, you're getting exactly this and this amount and at least most of the Danes that I've been with.
Yeah.
Like it's very, very planned out. Like we want you to have this exact experience.
Yeah.
And you're getting this many and this person's getting this many and it was very...
Does it change? Is it like that person got more or...
But I find it very, it's very strange to me because at least how I grew up in the States, it's sort of just, if you're coming to my house, like you're going to leave like rolling on the floor.
Yeah.
Like we're going to have to push you out. We're going to have to get like a forklift. Like that's how we are.
For me, it's like, you're going to get crackers and cheese whiz and like, enjoy. But yeah. Again, I think it goes back to the planned nature of hygge, right? And kind of really, because by the time you finally get to that guest house, right, this has been in the works for 3 months. Yeah. Like we said, right? Yeah. This isn't, hey, you come to my barbecue on Sunday. This is, okay, you got to perform if you're doing it once a quarter, right?
But also going into a Dane's home was also another big event, I think. You know, when you come into it and getting part of that inner circle.
Oh, man.
And being invited into a Dane's home.
Yeah.
And doing that experience. And I think, is it because of that point? It's because they've gone so far in that they want you to have the very best experience that they can give, or is it just the way that it's just done here? Which way would you say?
I think it comes back again to, you know, they're opening up by inviting you to the home, to that circle of trust. You know, I talk to a lot of expats, and usually the first time they're invited to a Danish home is for their goodbye meal. So maybe they've been living in Denmark for 2 to 3 years, and there you go. Your first time invited over is to say goodbye and thanks for being a good neighbor. Maybe you talked 4 times. I hear that a lot. But I think it's because when Danes open up, you hear this cliche, you know, you have a friend for life if you want it.
No.
So that is a big deal. Whereas in other cultures, it's, okay, yeah, we're just having a meal. It's not a big deal.
Live fast, and is that it? Like, you know, kind of reversing back to the, you know, every time I walk into a store in America, everyone has to say hello and how, and ask me how I am. Like, you don't really care.
They don't
get there is no, yeah. And is that kind of that mentality? You don't get asked how you are unless someone actually really wants to know how you are. Or
yeah, to a degree. Yeah, I mean, there's still a, you know, one goal, and you know,
yeah.
You know, you don't have to give these like psychological dispensations about how you're doing. But yeah, definitely a lot more directness and a lot less of the fluff. It makes it, I think, very difficult. If we talk about networking and, you know, small talk and these things, it doesn't come naturally, I think, to Danes.
I think the other thing, too, from what I'm seeing, especially, let's say, if you come in as an expat, like as an adult, I feel like a lot of Danes, for the most part, not completely, but have kind of established their social circles, let's say by the time they've gone through university-ish, if not even before then, high school, et cetera. And for this networking coming in, let's say as an adult, as an expat, most of the Danes you'll meet will kind of have relatively established social circles and aren't really looking necessarily to expand them.
That's right.
Or integrate new people or whatnot. So it becomes quite difficult to find Danes to hang out with.
Yeah, Alex, you're spot on. And I mean, again, we can look at the educational sector, right? In Denmark, you go to a school with the same classmates for 10 years, from age 6 to 15. Every year, you're with the same 20, 25 kids. So you see a lot of these friendships that are from age 6. And then you have, you know, gymnasium or high school and clubs, right? These different clubs. So by the time, you as this expat dude in your 20s, 30s, 40s comes into the picture, there's this kind of lack of hunger for expanding the network. Because again, it goes back to that satisfaction that, you know, they have their buddies from, you know, 30 years. And what's kind of the ROI for them to stepping outside their comfort zone, speaking their non-native language and letting you in? If they're basically satisfied, that's the big challenge of kind of trying to preach the growth mindset
and so happy in themselves.
It's a catch 22, right? I mean, it's really a problem. Actually, I think if you talk about growth.
I think the other thing about it too is I tend to find that just by the very nature of being an expat, tends to be very, very transient.
Yeah,
and so you might be here for, I don't know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah,
more than that, I mean, unless you've been picked up by a Viking, more than that is probably...
Your contract renewed.
Get your Viking contract renewed. You know, it's probably unlikely. And I get the impression that compared to some of the other countries I've lived, the Danes are sort of being like, oh, if you're only going to be here for 2-3 years, then like you said, what is the ROI? What's the point? Why make the effort? Because then you're gone. And even I've seen some Danes who have sort of made the effort and brought people in. And then when inevitably with the way expats are, they moved on. That was like a big blow to them.
Yeah.
Like it hit them very hard that, oh, wait, I thought you were going to be here. And now all of a sudden, you know, you've been here, I don't know, 4 years. Now all of a sudden you're moving on they're struggling with dealing with that.
Yeah. Because they're not used to the loss in the same way because as an expat, you become kind of anesthetized to that because it's so transient, right? Yeah. I completely agree. I see it all the time, and I think it's kind of all or nothing, right? Why you really have to, if you're basically satisfied, you have to ask yourself, why should I come outside of my comfort zone? Because it's essentially that psychological move of why should I grow? So really it's about explaining what the positive, you know, positivity of a growth mindset can bring about.
So, and this might be twisting your words a little bit, but are you
that's a disclaimer.
That's a disclaimer. that would somewhat seem to suggest that there's a bit of an issue with sort of a stagnation mindset here, and sort of this
fixed mindset.
Yeah, sort of a fixed of I don't want to say anti-growth, but sort of, you know, we're comfortable, so we're not really going to change, or we're not going to improve. And for me, that's stagnation. But if you want to call it fixed, we can call it fixed. We can use whatever terms you want. Yeah. And I feel like that long-term is hampering overall. Like I personally don't believe that's a good thing. I think you kind of need to be growing all the time and get bettering yourself and rising to a higher level and so on and so forth. But
absolutely. I mean, that's kind of, you know, my whole mission is to try to advocate for having a growth mindset. You know, I know it in my own life that, you know, there's the comfort zone, and then you have to take risks. You have to step outside of that comfort if you want to grow as a person or if you want to grow as a nation. And, you know, those that do, they grow. Mm-hmm. And those that don't come out of their comfort zones, they stagnate, right? And that's going to have long-term effects on the society. Absolutely.
It's interesting because I don't see the kind of closeness as I hear from you of what you experience. And I think, does that come from coming in from a different way?
Because you got a Viking and I did not get a Viking, is I think yeah. what the realistic answer to that question is.
Is that then I'm not plunder. Which line you stand on? Is it you're with or without a Viking? Is that how then you determine how lucky you are or how hooga you become?
Because you know I work with Danes that have been abroad and come back, and they go through a lot of the same challenges as expats reintegrating. And I think it's because once you're out in the world, you're that global citizen, have the global perspective. You come back into a country of, 5.8 million that kind of operates generally the same way. And it's really difficult to kind of conform to that. You know, you hear these stories all the time. People have been abroad for 10 years and it gets reduced to, you know, a 3 to 5 minute soundbite at a party, and then you're right back into, okay, this is how we do things. And it's, yeah, it's, yeah, it really takes a toll on you.
Here.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can talk about what helped you.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, yeah, for me, I didn't see any of these issues. We had a great circle and having my partner's friends that I became friends with as well in a different way. And I have a very different relationship with my partner's friends. Like, for example, there's a girl that she went to school with during those 10 years, 350 kilometers the other side of the country. But it ends up that we're both Arsenal fans, and you know, we have a load of things in common, and I get on well with her best friend, with her friend from school, which she didn't really like. Or didn't get along with at that time. And it's just because they're in the same class.
And you're saying this is not just to piss your partner?
No, she knows this. It's a very common thing. Like, we got put onto the first table because of me at their wedding, right? It's it's just the, you know, I think the barrier of getting into the circles was you can kind of see it as well. It's tough. But then again, I've never been out on a night out in Copenhagen and stayed on the same table as I went out on. In that same sense, is that the table expands, you get some other people sitting down, and then all of a sudden you're chatting to these other people, and then you're having beers and enjoying time with these other people that you didn't know before that point. I don't know what it's like from where you're from in the US, but I can tell you from a fact, even in sunny, leafy suburbia of Surrey, in England it's not like that. You say anything to anyone, they're like, why are you talking to me? And you're like, I'm just making casual conversation because you're right next to me. I mean, it's just that kind of that politeness or kind of, yeah. I don't know. And that for me, then I've grown my circle through that plenty of times, you know, and there are events, even for entrepreneurs to kind of get into that bubble, and, you know, great events like Startup Weekend where you can meet like-minded people and go through that kind of process.
That's key.
And you know, is that one of the ways of getting into the into the country? And, you know, I've got a lot of entrepreneur friends from that sense, but there are also other friends that I know that don't have an idea what an entrepreneur is or an idea of what the tech stuff happens.
Sure. I think living in Copenhagen is hugely beneficial. You know, I talk to people that are in, you know, smaller towns in Denmark. It's a different ballgame. The amount of diversity here makes it so much easier as an expat, right? And you know, the business is the capital region, right?
I couldn't see my life in Vada, on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but even something like Billund. Let's say if you had to work if you had to work for Lego, for example.
Oh yeah, like, I mean, I talk to people; they have a lot of issues all the time. You know,
I actually had this conversation with Billund. Is my wife, who's from Vada, on that side of the country, wouldn't even go to Billund now to live and to be. There's like, you have to go to Vaila. And it's 45 minutes away, half an hour away, and you can do that instead. And that's a city, which is like the fourth or fifth biggest city in Denmark. So sure. I think even the Danes have that reservation of going into that far out into Denmark, right?
It's funny because you can hop on a train and you can visit the whole country within a day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think definitely someone that comes in with a positive mentality and is extroverted and makes an attempt, and finding people that have similar activities, that's crucial, right? Yeah. Because, you know, once you have similar, you know, passions, you know, the other stuff, the kind of the linguistic, cultural barriers, they can melt away a little bit. I think the younger generations too, you know, it's getting better and better, mm-hmm. especially.
Is that through the advent of technology?
Yeah.
Or just the way that technology has enabled them to be more knowledgeable and broad-minded? Or which element would you say is...
Yeah, I think it's the...
I would also add the addition of, I think technology is now connecting them to other cultures in a way that the older generation probably weren't.
So
now they're actually interacting with other cultures on a more day-to-day.
For sure, yeah. Technology is bringing the world closer together and making it easier and easier, definitely.
Well,
and the English skills of the population are increasing per generation. So if that's the global language, that makes it a lot easier.
No, that's very true. Even here, I, without speaking Danish, I could literally have a conversation with the one above, you know, the next generation above, behind. And even some uncles or aunties still.
Yeah.
There is no, you know, it's better to speak German in those parts of the country.
Yeah, and I mean, you guys know when you travel throughout Europe, that's not the case, you know.
Yeah.
You start speaking English and you're just hoping your taxi driver can...
Yeah, exactly.
Figure it out.
And you know, you actually try and make that push across, but I think it's that culture, the blessing and curse at the same time. But with that moment there, I mean, like, you know, we've wrapped up into Denmark quite a lot. I think that brings us to the end of our second section.
Sounds good to me.
I think what we'll do now is that
time for a quick break.
Yeah, time for a quick break, and after that we jump back into a little bit more about you, Thomas, and
the company you've started, probably.
Yeah,
we'll get into how that started. We should probably talk about it.
You love.
No worries.
Hi everybody, welcome back to the last segment here with Thomas. It's been really, really interesting so far, kind of three non-Danes dissecting Danish culture for two segments.
Putting the standard of what Danish culture is, I think we have a Danish person in the listening.
So I think we're coining a term, expat-splaining. We are expat-splaining.
Explaining.
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 So that is what we're doing now. Three people, anyways.
Wow.
Thank
God I'm not white. It's the other way to be. Three white dudes explaining. explaining.
Anyways, so Thomas, coming kind of jumping back into your story, like a little bit on a more personal level. So you came to Denmark at that point it was your fiance. You got married after being here.
Yeah.
What were you doing when you like initially got here, and kind of can you get us a little bit of how that evolved into what you're doing now and how that started?
So I think like a lot of expats, it was easiest for me to come into the job market as an English teacher. So I taught English as a foreign language.
Just a quick on that, because I did that for 6 years. Aren't we like unbelievably lucky to happen to be born in a specific country where we can get a job anywhere in the world?
Oh, I mean,
I think it's absurd. It blows my mind.
The Germans are like, it's ridiculous, people.
Yeah,
so the law.
Like, we can get a relative, in most places, a relatively decent paying job Yeah. Fairly easily, just because we were born in a specific
just by
country.
Speaking. So is it just one of the
things? And being shitty teachers and just
Yeah, we don't have to be good teachers. Yeah. No, we can
there's
be
no pedagogical approach.
No, we don't have to be good at all.
Yeah, you can't explain why you're doing it. Just say it.
Just do
say
it. This do. Is the English way.
So that was my approach to it, right?
Okay. That was my approach.
So I didn't last long in that field.
I'm going to ask, as much as you were nurturing the next generation in that sense.
Yeah. So started out, that kind of evolved. I started working with Danish leaders kind of one-on-one.
How did you jump from teaching English to working with Danish leaders?
It was through the same company. I did this global leadership training, and then it was kind of more tailored to presentations, meetings, and negotiations in English. So it was just kind of more tailored there.
So literally it's either immigrants or expats. Was that just am I?
It was
in that sense.
It was me teaching English to Danish leaders.
Oh, it's in that sense. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so that was cool for me because it was always, I'm curious and I like to learn new things. So I was always diving into different industries and sectors and getting to, really build up these relationships with these kind of high profile people in a way that you normally don't get to do.
Is that by luck then, would you say that, that is perchance, you're part of a collective that connected you with then all of a sudden high networked Danish people and you could leverage upon that in the same way?
That was part of the reason I did it. I mean, I wanted to, I was aware of kind of who the clientele was and I was always aware of kind of the power of networking and where I wanted to go. One of my students happened to be a headmaster at a private school in Copenhagen, and we got talking, and they had a school with over 55 different countries represented, a huge amount of diversity. Wow. But they very much ran things a Danish way, and they wanted to look at it making an international department and really branding themselves more globally. So they brought me in as a PR consultant, and that was at the end of 12.
Did you do any PR beforehand, like any marketing or from that background, or just jumped into it?
No, I was in communications, and my academic background, that was in philosophy and psychology.
Yeah,
but I mean PR I think is a lot with psychology and understanding people's drivers. So although I didn't work in it professionally, I just jumped right in. So let's do it. Yeah. Let's go. Branding, PR. So I was actually given free rein to really look at an organization that was just run in a Danish way for over 150 years and make it into an international organization.
What were some of the, let's say, challenges that they were facing to do that transition? Because to me, it seems like a conversation that I'm having with a number of Danish organizations is how do you kind of make that jump from being sort of a really localized, very kind of almost niche cultural group into being a more international, kind of almost cosmopolitan setup.
Yeah, I mean, it requires a change in mindset. It requires that you're willing to open up to new ways of behaving. Mm-hmm. And the organization at the highest level, it requires that the board and the leadership is buying in. That's key. Because if you don't have it at the top levels, it's going to be dead on arrival. So there was a really positive board, and the head of the school was really positive and really wanted to do something, because at that time the government was cutting back on funding. They needed to economically do something different to position themselves in the market. So they looked at the international way as the way to go. So they had the kind of the economic need, and they had the mindset for change at the top. But then actually going in and doing it, that's a process.
I think one thing that's kind of interesting about that, and a trend that I'm sort of seeing play out in Denmark that sort of parallels ones that's playing out in the United States, is that basically, public institutions in the US and all education here is public are getting less and less funding. And so essentially to make up these funding gaps, they're being forced to get more international, because the internationals pay, in the States, they pay a lot more, and in Denmark, they pay it all.
Yeah.
I mean, oversimplifying things, but basically.
Yeah.
And I find it, it's very, very interesting. I mean, maybe they're probably 5 years behind of what's been happening in a lot of the public institutions in the States, but I see that basic same story playing out here in sort of the universities and so on and so forth, where now all of a sudden, they more or less to meet budgetary gaps, need to increase the number of foreigners because those are the ones who are actually going to be paying for the education, and less it's coming from the government.
Yeah, that's definitely the economic reality of it. Although at the same time, the government's putting in quotas on the amount of international students to bring in.
So again, we're talking about the
contradictory trends, and it's between the nationalistic and globalistic, you know, actors, right? Yeah. But yeah. I mean, you see that a lot. It's these two polar kind of motivations going at each other, and the result
with the same goal ultimately in changing, you know, the way that they would want to have things. Is that, you know,
different goals?
Those are very different goals. Yeah. And in that kind of element, same mechanism, sorry, in that it's the government side, and it's two sides of that coin. You know, you have to kind of represent both sides, and you have to put it into operation.
That's right. It's that balance between the national and the global.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So going back into it, then you PR.
So I came in. So they're looking, okay, first of all, how do we make a Danish organization more global? Well, first of all, everything's in Danish, right? So I look at it. They're talking about their brand, their mission, and how wonderful it is. I said, no one can fucking read this. It's in Danish.
I have a question. Like, I see this time and time again that's like a huge shock to people. Like, why is that not like the first most obvious thing to do? Be like, wait a second. We want to become international. Let's get into a language that most people speak. Like
it's amazing, isn't it?
But it's amazing. Often I see that mentality.
It's this blind spot. It really is a blind spot that, because they can read it, they think, oh, I forgot to think about. It's like almost a lack of cognitive empathy that actually people can't read it. Getting everything overhauled, all the branding material, and then really starting to position themselves through their diversity in terms of recruitment. And I was tasked with, okay, the possibility of opening up an international line. What I could see was that at that school, it would have immediately, if we just went with a traditional international line, it would have created an us and them culture, mm-hmm. with a minority international department and a majority Danish department. And I was thinking, okay, how can we overcome this systematic barrier between us and them? So I thought, okay, I need to create a solution where we work on integration of expats and internationalization of the Danes simultaneously. And that was the big kind of idea that ultimately led to the creation of Globally Local years later. But it was, how do we simultaneously work with internationalization and integration, mm-hmm. therefore bringing together all stakeholders into one forum? And I could do it in the educational sector through the medium of bilingual education, which I saw in other European countries, specifically the Netherlands, that they were doing it at a huge scale. And I thought, why can't we do it here?
My question around that is what do you see? Like so you're saying you take these two sides and you kind of bring them to somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
What is that kind of crossover point? Like what is this sort of, because it's not really completely internationalization. It's not really completely assimilation. It's somewhere kind of in the middle, overlapping of the two.
Right. Globalization.
Glocalization. Glocalization. Okay. So glocalization. I like that. I like that term, glocalization.
Yeah. Exactly. It is that meeting in the middle, right? And I think in terms of change management, we're talking about Danish organizations making that move. You don't want to marginalize, even though they're the power, they have the power and the majority, Danes through an internationalization process. You know, you want to empower them to take those steps outside of the comfort zone and grow through internationalization, but while simultaneously showing that, okay, well, this group, the expats, they're also taking steps to integrate. So it's kind of that goodwill building up, right?
I mean, I think there's also an element of like trying to get the best of both.
Yeah,
and certainly I think from all of my travels, every single culture has something to offer and has some strengths and has things that you can learn from. And and you wouldn't want to, like, it wouldn't be helping anyone to just completely throw away all the strengths of Danish culture. Like that's also not something you want. You don't want it to become completely sort of internationalized. But finding sort of the right balance of, okay, what are our strengths that we can bring to the table into the conversation? And then what are the, let's say the strengths that we're missing that the expats can bring to the table, and to have this, I like your glocalization is the hybrid of both.
Exactly. So that's kind of the formula I was looking for. And I thought, okay, here's our opportunity to experiment with this glocalization model in this sector, right? So luckily I was given, you know, a lot of freedom to work with it. And we did it originally, we started up with this kind of summer school pilot program. And at the time, no one was doing any summer schools. So I thought, okay, in July, everything was closed down in the school world. Here's our opportunity to try something really unique and just to test the market, right? So I opened it up. We were going to do one program where everything we did was going to be in Danish and in English. And it was going to be with equal emphasis on Danish culture, but also having the Danish kids learn English and, you know, that hybrid, right? Yeah. And it was a huge success, right? And people were astounded that, oh, it's not either or. You can have both and, which was this mind-boggling in this monoculture, right? That you could have this pluralistic success story. And that was that pilot win I needed to be able to sell to the board opening up bilingual back in 14.
So the whole school went bilingual? Was that
one department did.
Okay.
One department, and then there was, so one line, right? One track, okay. And then there was two Danish tracks. My goal was, I wanted the whole school to go bilingual, the whole country to go bilingual, if we talk about my goal.
Yeah. What were the hurdles, do you think, of making the whole school bilingual? Do you think, was that even a possibility?
It would have required the Danish majority to give up more of their power, and they didn't want to.
And that wasn't going to happen?
No. Yeah. Power dynamics.
Jumping off a different point of just thinking about this, like, do you think you would have come up with a similar solution if you weren't an American? Because this, to me, seems like very, very much something that would come out of the U.S. and how much of a melting pot society we have. And I mean, if you just look at places like the Southwest, hubs or whatever, where we have, you know, bilingual. Yeah. I mean, the biggest group is English Spanish, but in certain parts it's English Chinese. Yeah. And other groups, and you're talking about this pluralism. To me, that comes off as a very American idea, just because of how much of a melting pot that we are.
Yeah.
And do you think that, you know, because of your roots in the States, that had a big effect on thinking of like, hey, we need both, because if we're going to be a melting pot here, then you kind of have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I'm indebted to my American culture in terms of having that kind of melting pot mentality, and also the that kind of constant try to innovate and absolutely.
Well, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about us, right, which is not the same almost anywhere else you go, Americans are always like, we're a blank American.
Right, that hyphen.
That hyphen, yep. Whatever, or everyone, you know, when people will always talk to you, oh, where are you from? Oh, I'm from the States, but my family's from X. And my family's from Eastern Europe, mostly Eastern Europe and whatever, but everyone, you know, has I'm an American with X roots or X this, or I'm a, I don't know, Latino American or African American or Asian American or et cetera.
You nailed it right there. That is the essential point. How do you transform a monoculture into one where you have the hyphen? Yeah. Right? Because in doing so, you've kind of, we talk about the problem. You break down the problem of either assimilation or segregation, and you create a new hybrid third way, what I call authentic integration. And that's what it is. And it's really difficult.
You see that, but then jumping back to the other point from previously, is that are you now reverting back to then this patriotism, this I am an American, there is no hyphen now. And because of that, we've seen then this wave and your change of government, let's say, not to say it's on you, but you know, the change of government is because of this, is it not?
Well, I think there's a difference between patriotism and nationalism. I think patriotism can be inclusive, mm-hmm. whereas nationalism is exclusive.
Yeah.
So I think there can be inclusive patriotism where you can be proud of the values and some things in your country, but you want to expand that circle of trust. You know, that's what Robert Kennedy used to talk about in the States, inclusive patriotism. Whereas nationalism is, I think, more fear-driven and this kind of closing in on oneself.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things kind of coming off that as well is, I think this is one of the things that I'll say is different about the United States, is essentially the way America works is you're an American if you come to the U.S. and believe in the ideals. It's not like you don't need a specific background. You're an American if you want to be one, and if you want to be one bad enough that you'll uproot your life and move there.
Yeah, and if you want to be Italian American or Irish American, that's you're still an American, but you have that you have that history, right?
It actually makes me think: are there any other cultures in the world that allow you to do that, where you can be like that? Is it, you know, it doesn't happen in Australia. They're all from over there. Of course, you have that kind of, doesn't happen in England.
There's a little bit of that. I spent a number of years in Brazil. There's a little bit of that in Brazil because Brazil actually has a fairly similar history to the U.S.
I would love to see the Italian Brazilians.
They are very, very beautiful. They are very, very beautiful. But they have a mix of sort of the Portuguese, the German, the Italians, and so they do have a bit of a mixed multicultural history. And I would say from my experience down there, it reminded me of the U.S. a lot. It's sort of just the South American version of the U.S. in a lot of ways.
With a few more rainforests and parrots. I'm stereotyping.
when they used to have their rainforests.
Yeah, when they used to
let them burn.
Because the culture of corporalism came in. Is that am I going too deep now? Is that too tough?
But I think it's very, very rare, broadly speaking. But if you think about it, right, most countries, at least in the West, Middle East, Asia, you had a specific group of people, maybe China not as much, but you had a specific group of people that was living there for a really, really long time. So being from that country was directly connected to being a specific ethnic group.
Yeah.
And there's very few countries in the world where that is not really the case. Yeah. And most of them, I would say, are probably in the Americas based on the age of exploration and these types of things.
You got the Canadians and there's the French Canadians, of course. Mm-hmm. I would love to see the Italian.
I mean,
Canadians.
That's where bilingual education was, you know, really took off, was in Quebec.
Yeah.
Because of the French and the English.
So there is, going back to it, there are ways of doing it and actually putting it into society. I wonder
that,
now,
that's
is,
one
it,
sector,
is that
yeah.
still so prevalent? You know, do people class themselves? We have to get someone from Quebec over, Alex, and just we'll have this discussion.
I mean, I have a bunch of Canadian friends. We could probably make that work.
But then you say you in the school, going to that, and then you kind of jump from that point.
Yeah, so we took that, you know, to its natural conclusion of grade 0 to 9 in the Danish system. So fully built out, and now there's, you know, over 200 families and there's 100 kids on the waiting list. Huge success. And, you know, we really achieved, we brought Danes together, expats, blended families, and it's a huge success. And it's, you know, the pilot bilingual school. There's only 2 in Denmark. Whereas, for example, in the Netherlands, there's 150, there's over 35,000 kids in it.
Wow.
So, you know, so, but the essential components of internationalization integration, I use that to found Globally Local at the end of 2017, my company.
And can you, because we kind of touched on this, but not really, but in more detail, can you let people know what is Globally Local and really dive into?
So Globally Local, the company, is a consulting firm that operates in private, public, and educational sectors. We're a team of 8 consultants that have diverse backgrounds from HR to educational leadership, diversity management and inclusion, professor of marketing and management, different competencies, all tasked with creating holistic solutions within these 3 sectors. So in the private sector, we help companies, for example, like Carlsberg, run their diversity and inclusion training. We also help with onboarding of global talent when they come to Denmark. So how can we create a program where they're the employee, but also any of their stakeholders, their wife or kids, they're thriving once they come here? Because it's an investment. It costs over $500,000 to recruit talent from the outside. So it's about how do you protect that investment? So we create a tailored package looking at all the factors that contribute to well-being and integrating here in Denmark.
Just jumping off very quickly.
Culture, language, you name it.
For Carlsberg, I need to ask this question. Do you know how much of the HR process do you know? And are they allowed free beer? And is there a limit?
I mean, you walk in and there's this cooler full of beer. But I mean, it's non-alcoholic.
Okay.
During work hours.
Okay.
Wait, do they just have like...
But then there's the tasting days down at the lab.
But wait, is there a button on the fridges that they press like at 5 and then it like rotates and it switches
the secret key? Yeah. turns
around.
Yeah. Alex, if I tell you, I have to kill you.
Yeah, man.
All girls are really drunk. Sorry about that. Didn't interrupt the story. It's just
I'm not on the inside in that way. I'm just an external consultant.
Okay.
I haven't gotten the 5 o'clock key yet.
The 5 o'clock key.
So that's with private companies, but it's actually really interesting. You say you work on the public side as well. So
public
is that
sector,
with
yeah.
Communes and municipalities, or
yeah, exactly, all throughout Denmark. You know, really helping them with their international profiles and
okay.
So from Esbjerg to Odense to Copenhagen, because they all have similar initiatives, and that's how can we attract and retain global talent to our region.
I was going to say, is that for the comunas themselves? It's not. It's just to the region.
And the individual comuna. Yeah. Municipalities, yep.
And each one of them has different needs and different wants and has different draws, I'm sure. Like,
yeah, but they're similar. You know, it's businesses that, you know, want to be multinational, mm-hmm. that want to attract and retain global talent to their area. Because, like I said before, it's profitable not only for the business, but the municipality. Because you bring in these talented that don't take many of the benefits, but pay high tax.
Yeah, and also, you know,
it's good business.
You see it like going to SBF, for example, covering that, there's been a big boom with Maersk.
Yeah.
Then taking out of Copenhagen itself and going across the country. And
yeah, they're oil.
You can't find a decent-sized property because everyone that is mid-level executive and above has taken all of those. It's like Airbnb, but in reverse. Yeah, it's kind of the Danish way of Airbnb effect. Like, you know, people staying here long-term and paying a lot of taxes, but there are none available. You still don't have the availability of accommodation. But
yeah. So that's the public sector, and then educational sector.
Wait, can I just,
go ahead.
While we're doing that, jumping off your point, what are your thoughts on, because I'm finding one of the big things about integration here is sort of the issues around housing and how there's sort of this Danish system that Danes can get into, like once they're at 16, you have to be on waiting lists for years and then kind of everyone else gets what's left. And I think that becomes a big challenge for integrating when you kind of get here and realize like, okay, the market for, let's say, non-Danes is really, really small,
yeah,
with quite a lot of people competing for it.
Yeah.
And there are these systems in place that basically allow Danes to get on waiting lists before they even need to have a place, so that by the time they're ready to have a place, they're like at the top of the list and so on. And it's I think it's difficult. And I feel like I see that as one of the big challenges for an expat coming in.
It's difficult. I mean, when we talk about integration, there's the practicalities and then the more existential factors. And that's one of the practicalities that's kind of a hindrance. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I get why they do it. And it's the same with summer houses, why you have to have your Danish CPR number. It's because they didn't want foreigners to buy it all up and then just rent them out. Yeah. They wanted to actually have citizens and residents have an opportunity to be able to use them.
Yeah,
so sure. I get it, but it requires that they keep building. And, you know, also outside of Copenhagen, right, the suburbs. So yeah. I see those regions really expanding in the years to come because it's just a shortage.
Yeah, you're seeing like 1,000 new people coming into Copenhagen every month.
Yeah, Copenhagen is the area where everybody's coming to.
And, you know, you can find homes for 1,000 new people. And I think that's, yes, it's booming, but it's also going into that. It's also interesting to see, like, I don't think that the elements of what, you know, coming into it, the people where I actually lost that train of thought. It was actually fantastic, but I got just distracted. Something else came up.
We all believe you, James.
You can't see, so don't worry about that.
I can imagine what you're going to say.
Yeah. But going back to that, so, you know, then that's the companies and the municipalities is kind of covering everything that's international, connecting Denmark to the world and the world to Denmark. Is that kind of the plug and play?
That's element, the red thread, right? And that's, you know, what I run my podcast to, Global Denmark Podcast. It's about driving conversations that teach lessons to and for Denmark.
Yep. Yes, and just as a little plug there as well, I think it's a great show, and we're looking forward to be on it in a couple
of weeks. For and from Denmark,
sorry. Yeah.
Sorry for cutting.
Yeah. No, yeah, we are doing a sort of a collaboration with you guys, so we should plug that here, and we'll probably plug it separately. But we're looking forward to separately being on your show, and we're having your partner Ed also come on ours soon.
So, but this is Love the Problem. I mean, ultimately is that we cover the topics of what's important to you and getting to hear your story. So I think it's been a fascinating little session for me and seeing your points and where it comes in. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thomas, thank you so much.
Alex, James, thanks so much, guys. It's been a blast.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And look out for this. This will be a little bit later than normal, but we're going to do a special stuff with them in their podcast. All right. Thank you, guys. Hi, everybody. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Love the Problem podcast, this time with Thomas from Globally Local. It's very, very often that you'll hear expats bitch about the countries that they live in, but it's very, very rare that you'll get to get that on record. So I hope that was as much fun for you guys as it was for us. As we mentioned before, this was in a collaboration with the Global Denmark podcast. I was a guest on there last week, so please go check out their show. It was equally as fun, but in a very different format. Check it out. It's very, very much worth it. As always, please like, comment, let us know how we're doing. Tell us if there's any guests you want on, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.